Johnny comes marching home again. When Johnny comes marching home again. When Johnny comes marching home again, we'll all go out and welcome him. Never mind the shape he's in.
This is Scott Fratcher with Allison Thompson, on location at the 2003 Soul Fest, located in Hopland, California. The 2003 Soul Fest was a staging grounds for the Cancun Actions and many other current topics. Included in the lineup of speakers was Jim Hightower, David Orr, Granny D, Julia Butterfly Hill, and Starhawk. Jim Page, folk singer, will be talking with Radio for Peace International in just a few moments about his views on the World Trade Organization in Cancun, 9/11, and many other current topics. So stay tuned as Jim is on stage right now, and when he comes down, we're going to get to talk to him live.
When the sickness comes, later on when the sickness comes from chemicals and uranium, we'll wring our hands and we'll all play dumb.
This is Jim Page, and you are listening to Radio for Peace International from Costa Rica.
See the old veterans who did their part. The veterans who did their part. See the veterans who did their part and came back home with a purple heart. Walking around with a shopping cart.
Philip Elwood of the San Francisco Examiner wrote, Jim Page has been on the scene for more than 20 years and his reputation continues to grow. He has shared the stage with the likes of Bonnie Raitt, Emmylou Harris, Dan Byrne, Michelle Shock, Leftover Salmon, Mickey Hart, J.J. Cale, Robert Hunter, Chuck Brodsky, and John Hammond. His songs have been performed by Christy Moore, Michelle Hedges, John Trendle, the Doobie Brothers, Joanne Rand, Casey Neal, and yes, David Soul. Jim Page is often cited for his biting political pieces. He is in constant demand by the social movements of the day. More reminiscent of the Woody Guthrie I heard as a boy than anyone I've listened to in the intervening years. Julia Butterfly Hill wrote, The forests of the Northwest resonate with the music of Jim Page. His ability to holistically understand and passionately sing and play about the issues facing our forests and our world is compelling and inspirational. Listening to his music, I find myself crying one minute and laughing the next. Jim Page's music takes you on a journey of self-discovery. Julia Butterfly Hill.
This is Julia Butterfly Hill with listener-supported Radio for Peace International, your global community forum.
Get on with your life somehow. They're taking your little brother now.
Okay, so we're here with Jim Page. Did you have a defining moment in your career that made you change your music from just music to protest inspirational music?
Well, first of all, I don't use those words, protest inspirational. Protest to me is an insult word that it's kind of like politically correct. It's something that they came up with that I don't think we should use, if you know what I mean. Protest is like when I tell my 4-year-old son to clean up his room and he protests, he won't do it. I didn't have a defining moment. I graduated from high school in 1967. It was the 60s. It was the Vietnam War. It was the civil rights movement. Everybody that was playing songs played at least something, at least some bits of something that had a social awareness in it. It was just what everybody did. Everybody did it. So if I was going to go play in that theater, I was going to do that also. It was part of the consciousness. Everybody did it. Joan Baez, Bob Dylan, the Beatles, everybody did it. All the locals. So I never really had a defining moment. And the more I began to understand, at least think I understood, the history of what folk music is, because that's what I do, that's what I think of myself as doing. And my understanding of folk music came to be that it was music that came from the community and went back to the community. It did not brown nose to corporate power. That's not folk music. And a lot of what, or a certain amount of what happened in the 60s in the so-called folk boom was brown-nosing. Okay, you played on acoustic instruments and you whatever. But it was brown nosing music. You can always tell. I don't know if I can explain it, but you can tell it. But also, since that's what it does, it sings about people's conditions. It sings about their loves. It sings about their fist fights. It sings about their barroom brawls. It sings about their crops. It sings about crop failures, bountiful crops. It sings about court intrigues, politics, the whole thing. It sings about all of it. And I think we make a big mistake when we allow them, you know, the corporates, whatever you want to call them, to divide our world up for us. You know, our world is spherical. It's everything. Everything. And we should sing about everything just like we talk about everything. You don't hear, okay, don't go to those people. They're having a political conversation. They're having an ecological conversation. You just say those people are having a conversation. Mm-hmm. That's what you see. People are having a conversation. You don't have it broken up. We shouldn't do that to our music either. We should sing about everything. So that's why I don't like to use those words.
You've made some controversial statements on stage from time to time that you wouldn't hear on major media. And what type of reaction have you gotten with those statements?
Well, what statements do you mean? I mean, what statements? Like what?
June 26th is the anniversary of the firefight in South Dakota, Oglala Country, Pine Ridge, that put Leonard Peltier in prison for 27 years, long years. I mean, the question is really not whether we support them or not. That comes later. The first question is, are they our troops? Whose troops are they? America is an imperial country. They are imperial troops, whether we like it or not. They are an imperial force, whether we like it or not. We can talk later about whether to support them. First, we need to define who and what they are. No insults intended. Clinton gave us a general in charge of America.
They say they will incorporate the world. Sing! Over my dead body, over my dead body, over my dead body, over my... One more time. They say they will incorporate the world.
Now, this audience would understand that, but not all audiences would understand that. What type of reactions have you got from those types of statements?
Okay, well, I don't usually make that kind of statement to an audience that I know. There's no point in having people go blank. You want to make a statement like that to an audience that you at least imagine is going to be able to make progress with the thought, go somewhere with the thought, you know. And also, let's be honest, we're smarter than we pretend. Americans are smarter than we pretend. We play dumb. We've been playing dumb for a long, long, long time. But we're smarter than that. We're not ignorant. That's a myth. Everybody knows enough to put the pieces together to start to see the pattern and see the picture and then to do something about it. When they say they don't know, they're pretending. So, like a good comedian will make jabs at reality in such a way as to allow the audience to laugh, which is an emotional release, so that they can absorb the reality that the person just said and they can know that it's true, but they've laughed so they don't fight with it. Okay, and I've learned, I'm not, you know, sometimes I can do it, sometimes I can't, you know, it's whatever. But I try to do it in a way that's like that. I try to make statements like that in a way that it's in a batch of other things that I'm doing, which it'll make it okay. It'll make the thought okay. You know, after September 11th, I was scared to death for ages, for weeks. I was really nervous. I had a trip planned to Germany like 3 weeks after the attacks. And yipes, you know, international travel and all that stuff. And I was dropped off at the airport in Seattle and was crawling with soldiers. And I'd never seen that before in my airport in Seattle. But I had seen that before in Belfast, Northern Ireland, Northern Irish airport. And when I saw it in Seattle, it made me relax. Because I know what Belfast led to. It led to the people's victory. It led to a popular victory. It did. You know, the Brits have basically called it quits. You know, it's like we can't deal with these people anymore. They're too hard to deal with. We're going home. Basically is what they're doing. It's taking longer than, you know, some people would like them to. But, you know, the borders have pretty much dissolved. You know, there's this, you know, political power struggle going on. But it's over. They lost. The troops lost. And when I saw that in Seattle, I figured, okay, this is the final thing that it goes into. It goes into this armed occupation thing. Okay, we're occupying ourselves. And it could last 10 years, it could last 20, it could last 6 months. But it's not going to win. They are not going to win. You know, the history of locks is the history of lock picking, and the lock picker always wins. Okay? That's just the reality. I'm sorry. They're trying to figure out how to stop these hackers from sending these worms around. Sorry, they can't. All they can do is plug holes, and the hackers will find another one. You can't stop progress, human progress. So this is the last phase. So I was really nervous, though, going to Germany and all that stuff. And I wrote a couple of songs over there. One of them is the one I still do, for the most part, called Who Are They and Why Do They Hate Us? Because it has a larger feeling to it. It has an inclusiveness to it. It feels understanding towards somebody who's kind of frightened and hasn't been paying much attention to things, right?
Finger at my shoulder and it's keening fast. Questions I'm afraid of, but I have to ask. Who are they? And why do they hate us? Well, I was raised to believe in this American dream, all the greatness and glory, the way that it seemed. How God was on our side and God doesn't lie. So why do all those innocent people have to die? Who are they? And why do they hate us? Every color in the cloth has a history to tell. Ships across the ocean and the Liberty Bell. Heroes in the monuments, I know them by name. But now the granite jaws are shattered and their eyes are full of rain. My neighbor, she's a foreigner, I can't pronounce her name. When she talks about her homeland, her face fills with pain. She says she lost her children when the missiles hit. I don't know what to say, so I just change the subject. Who are they? And why do they hate us? I see the TV news and they're burning my flag in some faraway land where it's just another rag. The looks on their faces, they make me freeze. How in the world did we make so many enemies? Who are they? And why do they hate us? They tell me there are reasons for unthinkable acts. Rage and retribution won't bring anybody back. Justice is alive, so subtle and sublime. Well, I'd like to believe them, but we're running out of time. I never paid much attention, guess I should have known. Every faraway country is somebody's home. Empires rise and empires fall. The world is big enough, there should be room for us all. Who are they? And why do they hate us?
The other one, called Not My American Name, is much more blunt. You know, because at that time, what Bush and company were going to do, they were going to do in my name, and they were going to kill a lot of people. I remember an Afghani man standing up at a rally in Hamburg, Germany, before the bombing started, saying that 1 million people have already left the country as refugees. Okay, and the food agencies, international aid agencies, were saying that, what was the number, 7 million? 3 million? I don't remember. I want to say 3 million people could die, starve to death, as a result of the bombing, because they can't get the food in. Okay, all this stuff is going on. And I was thinking that my government is going to be doing this in my name. Okay, Jim Page, written on those bombs, Jim Page written on those coffins when those people die because they can't get the food because of the bombs, in my name, and that really pissed me off. So I wrote this thing that said, you can't do that in my name. I will not give you authority to do that. I'm going to speak out against you.
Well, they could hardly wait to get the triggers loaded when the airplanes hit and the towers exploded. You should have seen them on the big TV. It was the first great war of the 21st century. The flames were still burning, they already had their man. They said he was hiding in the mountains of Afghanistan. We asked to see the evidence, they said they couldn't show. This is war, they said, and that's all you need to know. America.
America, you're scaring me and making me ashamed. You're going out for blood and I can't let you do it. Not in my American name. You want to talk about the body count? Well, let's run it up the mast. Almost 4,000 people died in that New York City blast. And there's 5,000 people every month that you kill, strangling Iraq for a dirty dollar bill. And you want to talk about brutality? All right, let's get it out. Depleted uranium now, what's that all about? Innocent victims, can you even see their tears? Irradiated homelands for 4 billion years. And you want to talk about the terrorists and what makes them run? Well, you taught them everything they know. You even gave them their guns. Every killer with a grudge is just a tool to be used. And then you forget about them until they make the news. America, you're scaring me and making me ashamed. You're going up a blood and I can't let you do it. Not in my American name. The justice that you claim. Yeah, but the numbers that we're talking about are a whole different game. Millions of people have no safe place to hide. That's not justice, my friend, that's genocide. So I'm gonna have my say, and I'll say it loud and clear. In every crowd, in every corner, every place I can find an ear. And you can try to shut me up, but no matter what you do, I got a right to speak, and I'm American too. America, you're scaring me and making me ashamed. You're going off of blood and I can't let you do it. Not in my American name. America, you're scaring me and making me ashamed. You're going out for blood and I just can't let you do it. Not in my American name. Not in my American name.
So I wrote those two songs and I came back. And people for ages were walking around kind of stunned, not knowing what they could say to each other, what anyone could afford to hear. Or afford to say, right? And I would play those songs, you know, and people wouldn't do much. They would sit. And then they started to, when people began to feel that they would not get shot for showing certain responses, they would start to applaud. And then the applause got better. And people began to come out and say, I think just like that. And I remember one day playing downtown, doing Not My American Name, and this guy was standing right next to me watching me. And he looked like a Vietnam vet. He was about my age, kind of unkempt, you could say. His eyes had kind of a wild glint in them, at least that's how I perceived it. And he was looking at me seriously. It was a serious look in his eye. And I'm doing this song, and I'm thinking, well, is he going to hit me when I'm done? How am I going to deal with this guy when I'm done, okay, with the song? Because he was starting to make me nervous. When I finished the song, he walked right past me, stared me right in the face, and he said, that was brilliant. Walked off. Came back an hour later with his friend, and they found me. I was playing on the street downtown. They found me, okay? And he says, we are both high school teachers. You need to come down to Beaverton, Oregon, and sing to the students. And I went down and sang for about half the student body. And he made me sing that song. I did 4 shows in 1 day. He made me sing that song specifically every time. So that's how fast. It took about a month and a half, 2 months, for people to begin to feel okay about showing how they really felt. because as much as we have freedom of speech, as much as we have freedom of blah, 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 and so on, we also have a very heavily armed police force. We also have an enormous prison population, and we have constant surveillance. It was here before the Patriot Act. Don't worry about the Patriot Act. It's nonsense. It's been here for years. So people are scared. When something like that happens, people were scared. I was scared. And then I began to see that not only did people think like I was thinking, but that more of them than I thought would were thinking that way. So, okay, so people were coming out. They were, it's like, aha, you've put the pieces together. People have been putting those pieces together. I'm not the only one that thought what took you so long. A lot of people thought what took you so long. A lot of people did. In America, a lot of people did. So what we have to figure out, see, the way I figure it is, it's not a question of ignorance, it's a question of playing dumb. And the reason that we play dumb is, I think, many faceted, of course. You could be fired, you could lose friends, blah, blah, blah. But the main thing is, I think, is if you don't play dumb, if you admit what you see, and you put those pieces together, then you start to see a pattern, then you see a picture. Once you see that picture, then you know that you need to do something about it. It's like seeing somebody lying, you know, at the scene of an accident. You see it. You need to do something about it. If you just drive on by, you're left with that feeling of, I didn't do anything. It's a big feeling that can make you sick. It can give you cancer. It can interrupt your job. It can do everything. It can hurt you. Okay, you don't want, you can give you ulcers. You don't want to be left with that feeling. So people don't want to go there knowing, or at least believing, that there's nothing they can do about it. So what we need to do as political people in the world is come up with things that people can do. Come up with ways to show them that even if you don't know what you can do about it, start talking in public and you'll come up with something. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows everything, so what? Just start talking, brainstorming. Find other people that think like you do. You'll get together, you'll have a few beers, you'll have a cup of coffee, you go for a walk, whatever, and you come up with an idea and you'll do something. And then you'll feel energized. But it's that initial, oh my God, what can I do? I can't do anything, that stops people from putting the pieces together, I think. And that's the big block. We're told we're powerless. We're not. But we have to understand that we're not. And that's a hard bridge to cross.
Would you talk about the World Trade protests in Seattle and how they changed the view of the way that the protesters are taking things globally?
Use that word protester again.
That's okay. The World Trade Organization actions in Seattle. See, one of the way that things have changed, they don't call them protests anymore. They call them actions. Okay, people have gotten tired of the same old, same old, same old. They're actions, which is an activity, which means you're doing something. You're not just standing there saying no. No, you're doing something. Mm-hmm. They have actions. The people I hang out with go to actions. Okay, people learned in Seattle that they could. I mean, the World Trade Organization, I call it the wallet of the world. It's huge. This is not some little Mickey Mouse Lions Club thing. This is huge. People actually shut it down. They actually did. I was on the street Tuesday afternoon. I think it was something like 2 o'clock, 2:30, when the rumor went through that the meetings had been canceled. And it was just a rumor. But it turned out to be true. God, they actually canceled the meeting. It was amazing. Now, there was luck involved, and there was a geography of the town, the way it's laid out. But there was also the brilliance of the organizers. The way they did it was just astoundingly brilliant. And the stupidity of the, you know, of the law enforcement, you know, who are by definition stupid, by the way. That we have to always remember that. If I'm going to oppress you, I have to operate on a number of assumptions. And one of those assumptions is that I am your superior. Otherwise, I cannot justify oppressing you, right? I am your superior. As long as I assume I am your superior, you have the advantage. Because I won't expect you to be smart, will I? So you have a lot of room to move. You have a lot of room to, you know, to maneuver. So that's what they did. So, you know, people, organizers were allowed to be smart because they were being stupid. And anyway, it was a big boost for a lot of people that that could actually happen. And then there were other lessons to be learned along the road. There was the way over the top, you know, chemical warfare that happened in Quebec City. And then there was the killing that happened in Genoa. It's like, okay, so these people, if you push them hard enough, they will actually shoot. Now, that makes me a little nervous about Cancun because of what the Mexican police and military have done in the past to student protests on campuses. They've done Kent States in the past, you see, and that makes me a little bit nervous. We have to remember not to just kind of cavalierly go in and shut things down.
They were all over the place. Friends of mine who were working in the IMC, the Independent Media Center downtown, told me later that when the cops came that one time, that first time, to shut them down, to seal the doors, to say, look, you have to close these doors. We may have to evacuate you. The guy said, why are you doing this? And the cop says, we're just doing what the Secret Service told us to do. We are just doing what the Secret Service told us to do. Clinton was coming into town at 1 a.m. Wednesday morning. Madeleine Albright was stuck in her hotel room. She could not get out. She could blow up Yugoslavia, but she could not get out of her hotel room in Seattle. Okay? And Bill was coming to town. Remember Nice Bill? Now, you got to be careful. I hear a lot of people say anybody's better than Bush. Bush is only putting into activity the plans of people like Clinton arranged, okay? Do a little search sometimes. Slow down and do a little search, and you will find that Homeland Security has been on the book since 1996. It has been at least written up as a proposal since 1996. Homeland Defense is what they called it. Same thing. Clinton gave us a general in charge of America before the WTO. A general. We never had that before as part of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. By God, he did that to us. Cool. So we've been going in this way. So here we are. So Cancun, those of you going to Cancun. Excellent. I'm running out of time. This will be my last song. Introduction was longer than I planned. This is called Didn't We? Because we did. And we will again. And thank you very much. This has been wonderful. November 30th. 99, history walking on a tightrope line, big money pulling on invisible strings, getting into everything so deep. It's hard to believe it's in the food and the water and the air you breathe and the chemistry, the biotech, the banker with the bottomless check, the corporations and the CEOs, and the bottom line as the profit grows. The money talks, you talk back, they don't like it when you act like that, but didn't we? Shut it down, didn't we? November 30th, 99, it was a Tuesday morning when we drew the line. It was the WTO coming to town, and we swore we were going to shut it down. And they stood there with their big police. They had the National Guard out to keep the peace, with guns in the clubs and the chemical gas. But still we would not let them pass. And they raised and roared and their tempers flared, and there were bombs bursting in the daylight air. And they'd run us off, do us in, but we came right back again. Yeah, didn't we? Shut it down, didn't we? November 30th, 99, millennium passing as the numbers climb, and the people came from everywhere. There must have been 50,000 out there. There were farmers, unions, rank and file. Every grassroots has its own style. There were great big puppets, two stories tall. There were drummers drumming in the shopping malls. There were so many people that you couldn't see how that many people got into the city and the WTO delegates too. But we were locked down so they couldn't get through. And didn't we? Shut it down, didn't we? November 30th, 99, lockdown at the police line, and they're hitting you with everything they got. But you ain't moving, like it or not. And they're tying your wrists with plastic cuffs, and they're loading you up on a great big bus, and they're taking you down to the Navy base. Pepper spraying you right in the face. Try to break you down, try to get you to kneel. But you got the unity, and this is for real, and they can't break a spirit that's coming alive. That's the kind of spirit that's bound to survive. And didn't we? Shut it down, didn't we? The media loves all the glitter and flash. The newspaper's talking out a whole lot of trash about the violence of the people in black, and how the cops are so tired they just had to attack. And the secret's hidden in that deep dark hole of what they call City Hall may never be told. Out doing the spin. The police chief quit, so you can't ask him. Well, they can swear to God and all human law, but I was there and I know what I saw. And the visible stains are washed away in the rains, but this old town will never be the same. 'Cause didn't we shut it down? Didn't we? Now it's the greatest story ever told, David and Goliath, how you be so bold, standing up to the giant when the going gets hot, and all you got is a slingshot. Well, they tell me that the world turned upside down. You gotta pick it up and shake it, gotta turn it around. You gotta take it apart to rearrange it. I don't wanna stay the world, I wanna change it. Don't let them tell you that it can't be done, 'cause they're gonna be the first ones to run. Just take a little lesson from Seattle Town, WTO, and how we shut it down, didn't we? Shut it down, didn't we? November 30th, 99.
Another thing, just as an aside, eventually we're going to have to admit fully to ourselves, at least, what it is that we want to do and what it is that we are doing. For months after Seattle, you heard over and over again, the peaceful protesters, the peaceful protesters, the peaceful protesters. It began to irritate me. So I looked up the word peace in three or four different dictionaries to compare the word, you know, and they all agree that peace was the absence of civil disturbance. Now, whether you like it or not, when an entity has all the legal requirements in place, all the permits and everything to hold a meeting or a gathering, and you try to stop them from doing it, you are creating a civil disturbance, whether you like that or not. What you have to do is admit that you're creating a civil disturbance because the civil action that's going on is wrong. Okay, Nazi Germany was wrong. To stop the roundup of the Jews was not peaceful. That was creating a civil disturbance. But that had to be done. What happened in Seattle was not peaceful. A peaceful protester would stand on the street handing out leaflets and saying, excuse me, and staying as far away from the people as possible. You don't link arms in front of a convention center and stop delegates from going in and then say later on, you're peaceful. You weren't. You were disruptive. What's wrong with that? Yes, it's okay. You need to be disruptive. That's what you intended to do. We need to get to that point. I know this is a semantic thing, perhaps for legal maneuvering or whatever, but amongst ourselves, at least, we need to get to that point and stop this nonsense. You know, and then we can get somewhere farther because we're really making enormous progress. We are making enormous progress because if you remember, the WTO had to meet in, what was it, Qatar. They were like, you know, public gatherings were illegal. And then they met up at the top of this mountain in Alberta or something nobody could get to. It's silly. It's like, so everybody, my mother, God rest her soul, could look and see and ask the question, who are they? Why do they have to meet like that? What are they doing that they need to be surrounded by soldiers to keep the population away, which is what's happening. So it's great what we're doing. It's totally awesome what's going on. Totally awesome. And maybe you know this. You probably saw this last March, I think it was, before the Iraq thing happened. Noam Chomsky had gone to the Global Social Forum in Brazil. And he had written a piece, which I came across somewhere, in which he said the mood at the social forum was very positive and upbeat and excitement, filled with excitement, the possibilities, right? And then he says at the same time that was going on, the European Economic Summit was happening somewhere, you know, I forget where. And the mood there was gloom and doom, very depressed. And the guy that founded the European Economic Summit, don't remember his name, he was a banker of some kind, Chomsky quoted him, and the source was like the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or something. Chomsky's sources are almost always, you know, you can't argue with those, you know, He was quoted as saying, and I'm paraphrasing here, the game is up. The corporations have lost their power.
Yes.
That's what he said. The founder of the European Economic Summit said that. Mm-hmm. Okay. He's a big banker. He said that. Okay. So then I'm thinking, well, historically, isn't that why wars are always fought? So that they can rearrange the chessboard, they can move the money around, the corporations can get power again. Isn't it something like that?
That's mm-hmm. true. Yeah. Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah. So we got to watch, okay? So that's why this war thing is definitely, it's connected to the globalization. It's connected to the corporations. It's the Halliburtons. It's the Enrons. It's the same creeps that are the big corporate oil moguls and mineral moguls and the grand chessboard that Brzezinski writes about. You know, the world is a chessboard. That means I'm a piece of playing stuff in your hands. We need to say no to that very idea. The world is not a chessboard. Absolutely not. But that's how they think. That's how cynical they are. It's a corporate scum that are allied with the military scum that do these things. And it's ordinary people that always pay the price, like the soldier, the sergeant, Marine Corps sergeant who killed the woman in Basra, said the chick was in the way. Think about that one for a while, the chick. Do you have a sister or a mother, do you?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. How would you feel if somebody you don't know, some teenager, some 22-year-old you don't know, calls her a chick? Is that insulting, or do you like it?
No, that's insulting.
That's insulting? Okay, how about if he called her a chick after he killed her? We train them. They're ours. They're ours. He's ours. And this is what we're putting out there. And that I maintain that that's the only way they can be trained to do that. Otherwise, I'll ask too many questions. But, you know, what do I know? I'm just a guitar player, but that's really what I think.
And can you comment on how the media covered the world, the actions in Seattle compared to what you actually saw on the street?
I don't know if I can because I wasn't paying. Well, actually, you see, the media that I was watching in Seattle was the local, and they were for the most part standing with their jaws dropped because there was some camera guy of Channel 7 downtown that had a tear gas canister land on his shoe and blow up. Okay, the local city councilman, black city councilman, he was arrested by the riot cops, you know, beaten and everything. And he was quoted in the papers the next day as saying, yesterday I was a city councilman. Today I'm just another nigger. Okay, so the local TV stations, people that were getting pepper sprayed and all this other nonsense, they were actually pretty good in those couple of days there. I mean, you know, a lot of Mr. and Mrs. Normal were saying things like, well, they're rioters, they're crazy. So he just kind of, you know, brushed that off. Who cares? But it was But they were also saying, like, look at that police presence. What's going on here sort of thing. I watched TV for – there was a section when I was supposed to be doing a gig downtown, and the gig couldn't happen because the mayor had called a curfew. That's when martial law was declared. Oh, and I have to talk about that. Yeah. You'll like this. Hmm. And so – but I was in there for like 3 hours while we decided whether we had the meeting or not, and the TV was on. Other than that, I didn't watch it. So that's all I know. That's all I know. But mostly it was just like, oh my God, what's going on? What I want to say was, during the Oliver North trials, remember him?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It accidentally came out that Ollie and his friends, some of his friends, had drawn up a contingency plan in case of, you know, things got out of hand. First, a state of emergency would be declared. Second, the dissidents would be rounded up. Third, they would be placed in disused military bases. And this was a plan. I don't remember what the plan was called, but it would all be done under the umbrella of FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, right? Okay, that came out, and then they closed the door on it real fast, and they said, well, we'll talk about this later in secret, you know, committee, blah, blah, blah. That's off the subject or whatever, right? So, you know, it was forgotten. It went down the memory hole, as they say. Well, here it is all these years later, November 30th, 1999, and what happens in Seattle happens. Clinton is coming in 1 o'clock in the morning on Wednesday. So Tuesday, late afternoon, the shit hits the fan. And the mayor declares a state of emergency. The Constitution is suspended. That was number two. I forgot. I left that out. State of emergency. Then Constitution suspended. That's so you can round people up. Constitution was suspended. It was illegal to wear a button, to carry a sign. It was illegal to speak out. Anything against the meetings was against the law. I know union people who came up from Oakland, and they were going back at the end of Tuesday because they took the day off from work. They were going back through SeaTac Wednesday morning or something like that, and they wanted to take their signs and banners back with them, and they were confiscated at SeaTac, the airport, because they were illegal. That is a suspension of the Constitution. The possession of a gas mask was illegal, which is the protective device. It's like a seatbelt, okay? That was illegal. So state of emergency, constitution suspended. Dissidents were rounded up, 600 of them. Not a lot, you know, in comparison to some cases, but, you know, 600 of them. And they were all put on school buses, and they were taken to Sandpoint Naval Air Station, which is not too far from where I live, which is a disused military base. And guess what operates out of Sandpoint Naval Air Station now, among other things? FEMA. Yeah, interesting, isn't it? Yeah, it's very interesting.
I've heard of that plan before.
Yeah, yeah.
Interesting to hear an actual example of it put to use.
Well, these plans are there. The problem is Americans are raised to believe that we have these, you know, these freedoms, whether we do or not. We're raised to believe that we do, and we're kind of an argumentative population, and we don't like to have them messing with us that way. So they have to be careful how they try to pull this stuff off. They can only do it a little bit at a time. They have to scare the bejesus out of us in order to, you know, pull off some of this stuff, you know, and then to keep it up. I mean, when they had this emergency that, you know, someone might blow up the Golden Gate Bridge, okay, a year and a half ago, whenever it was, you know, everybody, there were articles in the paper that said, oh, that's just another red flag so they can pass more of this stuff, so they can keep Bush's ratings up. Everybody said that. You know, they got all the soldiers out there, and it's like, yeah, right. I mean, I thought after the Trade Tower events, and then they grounded all the planes, and they put all the soldiers, I thought, wait a minute, that just happened. It happened. The airplanes were used. They're not going to do it again. They just did it. That's closing the barn door after the horse got out. All they have to do now is, you know, just spread a rumor every 6 months. And we'll spend all this money and slow everything down. It's like the shoes. Now we're all x-raying our shoes. The guy did it already. He was a nutcase. He's in the joint. Okay, he was going to light his shoes on fire.
It'll be something new next time.
And then they'll, yeah, and then they'll slow us all down for that. Some guy goes in with something in his hair. Now they have us examining our hair. It's crazy. So I remember England in the old days when I was touring a lot. And Ireland was a big, big, big problem, and there were soldiers over there, and the H blocks were going on. They had the conveyor belt system where they would suspend all of your rights. Nobody had any rights at all. They would pick you up. They didn't have to charge you. It was Emergency Powers Acts. They didn't have to charge you up in Northern Ireland. They didn't have to charge you at all. Just pick you up. You literally disappeared. Nobody knew where you were or how long you were going to be gone. They would interrogate you in lots of grisly ways, let you out or not. It was called the conveyor belt system. You'd be picked up here, you move through the thing, and you'd be thrown out over there. When all that stuff is going on, they're spending all this money, millions and millions and millions of dollars. I'd be going through Heathrow Airport, the center of the sun never sets on the British Empire, right? And there were buckets on the floor. I'll never forget the buckets, collecting the drips from the ceiling because it leaked. I remember walking around London trying to find a payphone that worked. They're all broken. I remember the one that was hanging, the headset. The handle was broken in half. There were wires sticking out of it. This is the head. This is the center of the British Empire. Nothing worked. People were, you know, and we're headed in that direction. I really think so.
I was in Pine Ridge, South Dakota in June 26th. And I'd like to do a song connected with that. June 26th is the anniversary of the firefight in South Dakota, Oglala country. Pine Ridge, that put Leonard Peltier in prison for 27 years, long years. Very long years. I know that. Well, one of the things connected with that event is it was part of an ongoing series of things, which I suppose are still going on. Every country has skeletons in the closet, but we happen to have... We've got, like, dinosaur bones. We've got whole graveyards in the closet. And, you know, I don't think there's any harm, really, in opening the closet doors so that we get to look at them. We get to start to get realistic about who we are, how we got here. And unless we know who we are and how we got here, we can never figure out where we're going now, could we? So, anyway, part of that whole story is the death of Anna Mae Aquash. Anna Mae was a Mi'kmaq Indian woman from Nova Scotia, what is now called Nova Scotia, who became part of the American Indian Movement in the early 70s and was targeted for harassment and, if necessary, eventual disappearance. This was done by certain branches of our federal management agencies, or civil management agencies, also known as police departments. And in 1976, she was, in fact, disappeared. She was found by the side of the road in Pine Ridge, Oglala Country, South Dakota, by a white rancher named Roger Amiot. Myself, I figured that it was a story that should carry on, that we should remember her. So I set the tune to a traditional bluegrass ballad called Two Sisters. I tweaked the melody a little bit, I added a musical bridge, and it became a song of its own. It was called Anna May. And I'll sing it for you today. And we need to remember these things, because as we go into this 21st century, you see, America's dying. It's like it's its last gasp. I don't know about anybody else here, but when those two airplanes hit those two towers, and I watched on TV as they fell down, okay, when I got that phone call on that Tuesday morning to go watch TV because something had happened, and I turned it on, and there it was, the very first thought that popped into my mind, the very, very first thought was, what took you so long? I'm sorry, that was the first thought. And then I went through everything else, but that was my first thought. What took you so long? I mean, we, as a country, have been collectively slapping other people in the face around the world for a really long time. Really long time. It was only a matter of time before somebody slapped back. Now, I don't care what condition they are in, but we've been slapping them for a long time. So somebody slapped back. So that was my first thought. You know? So as we go into this century, you know, and we need to remember what has happened before to people who have challenged the federal government and the planning of things and the international consortiums, the, you know, the global communities of corporations that wanted the oil and the natural gas and the uranium in Pine Ridge, because that's what they wanted. That's what's there is uranium, natural gas, that sort of thing. It's always that. It's always money. So what happened to Anna May could happen to other people. We need to remember these things. They don't play games. They don't play games. Anna May came to the plains, I'm told, blow Dakota blow. From way up east to where the weather gets cold and the cold Dakota winds they blow. And she said, I hear there's been trouble down here, blow Dakota blow. They said, trouble, we've been getting trouble every year and the cold Dakota winds they blow. Anna May made a vow by the fire that night, blow Dakota blow. She would give her life to the people's fight and the cold Dakota winds they blow. And then the voice in the whispering of wind did say, blow Dakota blow. Somebody's gonna get hurt someday and the cold Dakota winds they blow. In 1972, blow Dakota blow. Trouble in the Pine Ridge settlement grew, and the cold Dakota winds they blow. And in 1973, blow Dakota blow. The trouble exploded a wounded knee, and the cold Dakota winds they blow. And in 1974, blow Dakota blow. There was a backlash beating at everybody's door in the cold Dakota winds they blow. And then the warning passed from tongue to tongue, blow Dakota blow, that there was trouble a-coming with the federal gun in the cold Dakota winds they blow. Just exactly why they never would say, but the cold Dakota winds they blow. Oh, they wanted some facts and they wanted some names, blow Dakota blow. But
But Anna Mae wouldn't tell him a thing. But the cold Dakota winds did. She said, you can kill me dead, or you can lock me away. Blow, Dakota, blow. 'Cause that's what you're gonna be doing anyway. And the cold Dakota winds did blow. And they said, all right, you're free to go. Blow, Dakota, blow. But just don't say we never warned you so. And the cold Dakota winds did blow. Anna Mae went out for a walk one night. Blow, Dakota, blow. Oh, but she never lived to see the morning light. And the cold Dakota winds did blow. Oh, it's a mystery, I heard it said. Blow, Dakota, blow. How Anna Mae died with the bullet in her head. And the cold Dakota winds did blow. Spread both far and wide. Blow, Dakota, blow. How another daughter of the people had died. And the cold Dakota winds did blow. And the people came from many a mile. Blow, Dakota, blow. To lay her away in traditional style. While the cold Dakota winds blow. And the sky covered over and the storm did come. With the cold Dakota winds that blow. And the voice in the howling of winds did say, blow, Dakota, blow. Somebody's gonna pay someday for the cold Dakota winds that blow.
What the smart English political people were able to do was put all those things together and show them to people, and they were able to organize around those things, you know, the labor people and so on. There's some really smart people over there, and we need to do that. We're going to have to do that. Our roads are going to fall apart. Our health care doesn't exist anyway for the most part. But veterans' benefits were taken away before they went over. I mean, that's crazy.
Oh, it's crazy. That's a travesty.
That is totally crazy. Before they went over. You know, and now they're complaining because, you know, they've been there for so long. And Vietnam vet friends of mine that I know said, yeah, when I was in the service, they'd send me over for 3 months. I knew it was going to be 3 months. When that 3 months was up, my tour was up, I was out of there. And you think about it, they said, yeah, but they had a draft. See, they could replace you. We don't have a draft. They can't replace them that easily. We don't have that many soldiers. And they can't do a draft. They can't. The shit would hit the fan because all the kids have Vietnam vet parents. They can't do it. They can't do it. It would be horrendous. They can't do it. What are they going to do? How are they going to pull this off? Britain, that's how they're going to pull it off. It's going to get uglier and stupider and stupider. Broker and broker. Nothing's going to work. The airplanes are going to be airports, armed camps. I mean, it's just, and we are going to be given the most wonderful opportunity to actually get to know each other. Because this is a wonderful population. It's a wonderful part of the world. It's a wonderful land base. It's a wonderful bunch of people that came from all different parts. I've never been to a place in the world that I didn't think was beautiful, and this is one of them I think is beautiful. People are great, and our government is a mess. It is. Our history is something that we need to look at. I don't know anybody alive who wrote the Constitution, who wrote the Declaration of Independence, who participated in the Indian Wars in those days, or who owned slaves. And since nobody alive did any of those things, then what's wrong with criticizing it in public? But people always take it personal. Don't you talk about Mike. I'm not talking about you. We need to talk about ourselves, who we are, how the country was built, robber barons and the land barons, George Bush's grandparents, the whole nine yards, who Andrew Jackson actually was the guy on the $20 bill, how he bragged he never met an Indian he didn't kill, and he never killed an Indian he didn't scalp. This is the guy on the $20 bill, how he signed the papers for the Trails of Tears to put the Indians on the march that killed about half of their populations, how that is directly correlative to, if that's a word, Adolf Eichmann, who only signed the papers to put the Jews on the railroad trains. He never killed anybody. I'm serious. He never did. We understand why Eichmann was executed. We don't question Andrew Jackson. We keep him on the money. I want him off the money. We need to change a lot of things, but first we need to look at them, and we need to not take it personally if things are questionable, because we're just born into it, you see. Don't take it so personally. We need to do these things.
We inherited it.
We inherited it, yeah.
We can create a different world for our children to inherit.
Right. I feel sorry for the right-wingers with their flags and their pompous defense mechanisms, because they're so insecure. They need to be defensive about something they have nothing to do with. And it's eating them alive, too. Mm-hmm. And they have nothing to do with it. But I think the situation is great, though, actually. All in all, I think it's excellent.
How do people get a hold of you? How can they order your CDs?
Well, the best way would be through my website, which is jimpage.net. You know, www.jimpage.net.
And would you spell that?
Jim Page is one word, JIMPAGE.net, NET. And it's got everything there. You know, how to get a hold of me. There's an email connection right there. You know, and the whole nine yards. It's easy. And the CDs and the tour schedule, which is not updated as much as it should be. But, you know, I like to play and I like to travel. And I like to be a part of the world we live in. So, yeah, that's it.
How many CDs do you have out?
How many CDs do I have out? I've got 5 CDs out. There's one that needs to be reissued, and I'm coming out with another 2 reasonably soon.
I like those words.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jim Page.
Thank you.
Well, the car's gassed up, and I'm ready to roll. I got one eye open for the highway patrol. I got the other eye open for the freeway sign. 300 miles and I'm making good time. And my stomach's growling, but my head's been fed. Going down to Eugene to see the Grateful Dead. Tape deck's blowing out a rattling sound. In a sympathetic rhythm till the wheel go round. Sports cars eat me up half alive. This thing don't do more than 55. But I can sleep in the back, it's a roadside bed. Going down to Eugene to see the great cold air.
You're listening to Radio for Peace International and an interview with Jim Page, taken at Soulfest 2003 in Hopland, California. Radio for Peace International would like to thank Soulfest for all their help in setting up these and many other interviews. This program was produced by Scott Fratcher and Allison Thompson. Scott Fratcher and Allison Thompson are both graduates of the Institute for Progressive Communications taught at the grounds of Radio for Peace International. You can find more information about Radio for Peace International at rfpi.org. That's www.rfpi.org.
Well, now there's 40,000 people in a great big bowl. They're all rocking to the rhythm of the roll. Some are falling in love, some are counting their money. Some are spinning in circles till their eyes get funny. Oh, but isn't that just about the way they said? I'm going down to Eugene to see the Grateful Dead. I'm going out into the parking lot, I might get lost. Best place in the world to get your wires crossed. Reality shatters when you leap and shout. Some people go in and they never get out. Never been the same since my senses fled. I'm going down to Eugene to see the Grateful Dead. Well, now everybody needs a little break sometimes. Life gets too precise. So put a little twist in the old straight line and take some strange advice. Well, you can take my work, we can throw it away. I'll put a penny in a parking meter any day. Hang out the phone bill and let it fade. Landlord's gonna have to wait to get paid. Cause I ain't got no use for your overhead. I'm going down to Eugene to see the Grateful Dead. My stomach's growling, but my head's been fed. Going down to Eugene to see the Grateful Dead.